So when a theorist starts to observe, this is some advice, there's a sort of a broad equilibrium, and you want to make enough mistakes that the observers think you're an amateur, because otherwise they're going to ask you questions. But you want to make few enough mistakes that the theorists still think you're an expert. That's actually a very broad equilibrium. You can make a lot of mistakes, and the theorists still say, oh, he knows how to observe. I've got an idea. So what I've been doing recently is deep searches. I think that's the same thing. So we may.
Okay. I need to find that guy.
Paris.
Was it Paris?
Yes.
The one that we came?
I think this is.
Where his office is?
Yes.
Which room is
it? Oh, wow, you have a weird one.
Mm-hmm. Need an adapter?
Yes, they do.
We need a connection.
An adapter, and then it
doesn't go.
Yeah, it doesn't go.
It's the other one.
It's the other one. It's a different adapter. We may have to postpone that. It's a.
What, Paris?
Okay.
Well, we normally get two adapters. So this is the one that works on
I probably could.
Well, because the machine that we have is.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Try to scan it
to
use
the X. Yeah, there's one.
Let's see here.
There's one that's like this, and there's another one that's kind of square. It doesn't help you tell the difference. That's a whole other. That's a whole other deal.
Both of the adapters I got work with my machine, but one of them works
for something
else.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's why
we
work.
I'm not sure I even had mail set up on here, though.
Yeah.
No, it's not set up, because I don't ever mail from here. Try it. Yeah. Bonus.
Is that the right one?
That's the.
Is that yet a third version?
No, I think that's the right one.
If it doesn't work, we have to throw your computer out.
Sorry?
I thought he should be here this week, but he's not here, so I have put him on for next week. And
should be at 7.
Put Chaz on for Thursday.
Oh,
he doesn't know Chaz Bachman, but he doesn't know about it yet. So. What's the problem? It's not on.
No.
No, it's well. Oh, you mean you need the heat? What happened?
Well, the little runny green light is off, and there's no, like, it's not a full screen.
We need to get to Paris.
Yeah.
You want me to get Paris?
I'm sure there's something stupid.
What we wanted you to invite us.
I mean,
you're keeping us in
the dark.
I mean, it must be. Oh, there is a man. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm having some
technical problems.
Can always be used to blink here.
Oh, yeah.
Something has happened here.
Oh, the green light.
The green light's blinking.
Oh, good.
Okay, so.
Well, it's kind of went to sleep and you couldn't get it back on yet. The projector.
Well, we had difficulty.
Yeah. I think it just
takes
time.
It's
just
trying
on
the back of it.
Yes.
Yeah. It's trying on the back of it and you hear it.
Yeah. Can you, let's move this over here so it's not.
Turn off the light.
Are you setting up here?
Let's see.
Mirroring?
Where do I check mirroring?
In the
system preferences?
Yeah.
Displays or?
Yeah, displays.
Okay. Okay, so let's try this. And
you got to put one on top of the other. Click here, display.
Okay, so
he said who wants to organize Thursday's social hour? Anyone want to?
Where is that?
Any volunteers for Thursday's social hour or Friday?
When you did mirror, it's on somewhere else. It's on the other. Yeah, so you got a mirror display.
Okay.
Or
this one.
Whatever.
Yeah, okay. All right. You're still on your back. Okay.
Thank you very much. Matt.
Thank you. All right. So we've averted disaster.
Okay.
So what I want to talk about today is some photometric follow-up observations of Ogle TR10 that I've done within the last year. But I want to give you a quick overview of other things that I do. Recently, I've been involved in deep wide-field searches for irregular satellites of the giant planets. We have a paper coming out in Nature on results of our search for Neptune irregular satellites. I've been involved in deep searches for Kuiper Belt objects primarily with Gary Bernstein, using the advanced camera for surveys on the HST to look for the faintest Kuiper Belt object, in fact, the faintest solar system objects detected. Some of you heard about KH15D here. This is a circumbinary disk system that has been processing into the line of sight. I've also been working with Mark Kushner on dynamics of dust and disk systems, and you'll hear some of that stuff from him on Thursday. I work on long-term stability of extrasolar planetary systems, and then the last thing here that I'll talk about today is follow-up observations of extrasolar planetary transits. The motivation is essentially that most planets are discovered with radio velocity searches, and these give you the orbital period, the eccentricity argument of periastron, and a minimum mass. And you can use this technique to search for the presence of other planets. And if you do find other planets, sometimes you can constrain the inclination. But you don't get the direct measurement of mass, and you certainly don't get a measurement of the radius of the planet, which is one of the things that we're most interested in, because that's what tells you, it's a primary property of the planet that gives you a lot of information about what physics was involved in the formation of the planet. Transit observations are somewhat complementary. I mean, you get the orbital period again, you get a ratio of the planetary radius to the stellar radius, you get a measurement of the semi-major axis over the stellar radius, you get an inclination, because it's got to be close enough to 90 to have a transit, you get actually quite a bit of stellar information about the stellar surface. In some cases, like in eclipsing binaries, you can get a measure of the eccentricity. And I'll touch a little bit at the end on the presence of using transit observations, timings in particular, to test for the presence of other planets.
You also get the spectrum.
You can measure in some cases you can measure the atmosphere of the planet or some information about that. Yeah. So this is a quick diagram from one of the papers by Tim Brown, just giving an idea of what you're observing. So here's a dark planet transiting across the face of a star, and the corresponding relative flux. And there are basically four places that you want to care about, four timings here. Basically, the four points of contact where the planet first touches the limb of the star, when the planet passes entirely within the limb of the star, and the other two points. The primary things that you can measure is, the time interval here and here, this time interval, and also this shape of this, the bottom of the light curve. And this is basically, the reason why this is curved is that the star is generally not uniformly bright across its surface. There's a limb darkening, so it's darker on the edge and brighter in the center, so that as the planet passes across the face, it's actually occulting a brighter patch, and therefore you get a deeper light curve feature. So you all know about HD 209458, and these are the fantastic observations done with STIS, using STIS essentially as a photometer, where you get these, you see basically four different transits observed to be able to fill in a full light curve. These are patches when the HST was blocked by the Earth. So this is really something to strive for, or these are 10 to the minus 4 relative observations. So these are those four light curves folded together. Of course, if you had abundant time on the HST, every time you find a planetary transit candidate, you would say, okay, let's go observe it with the HST, where you have fantastic image quality, and you can get relative photometry of this level. But unfortunately, reality rears its ugly head and says that you can't have infinite HST time. So my question is, how well can we do from the ground? Is it possible to do better than millimagnitude, 10 to the minus 3 relative photometry from the ground? And so I'm going to talk just about Ogle TR10. And so,
could I just ask you on the previous slide?
Yep.
If you look at the middle of the eclipse, there's some fluctuations there.
Yep.
Are these real? Do they represent some kind of spots on the star?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, if you look at the out of transit regions, there's quite a bit of scatter there as well. There's a couple of different things that might happen.
Why don't you see the same kind of fluctuation during ingress and egress?
You might.
You wouldn't see the change in the steep line.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they could be vertically quite offset.
Still be on the line.
Yeah. So, the Ogle search for planets is based in Las Campanas, Chile. It's a wide field search of millions of stars, and they've turned up 100 plus transit candidates. And the unfortunate thing is that the bulk of these transit candidates are false detections. They're usually eclipsing binaries masquerading as shallow, 1 to 2% eclipses. The way you get an eclipsing binary to look like a planetary transit is grazing geometry or having a third star in the system that dilutes, adds most of the light, so that a very large magnitude decrease of an eclipsing binary is made to appear shallow. So I picked Ogle 10 for a number of reasons. The period was well established by observing, Ogle observed with 7 different transits and had a pretty decent period. No large radial velocity variations had been detected at the 100 to 200 meter per second range. So that means that you know, this is not a grazing eclipse of a stellar system. Otherwise, you'd see a large radial velocity amplitude. There's no spectral evidence of another star in the system at sort of the 5% level. And there's no evidence that this is in sort of a nearly, you know, in an eclipsing binary system, you often see out of eclipse variations that, you know, that follow the orbital period, and there's no evidence of that. So this is just a brief picture based on Konatskiel's paper. This sort of the star TR10 is essentially a solar type star. It's, you know, canonical solar type star, same surface gravity, effective temperature, rotation velocity. That's the main thing to take away from that view graph, is that we really are talking about solar type star. So before I even talk about the observations and the data reduction, I want to just jump to the results. This is the I-band light curve that I observed from Magellan with a 6.5 meter telescope. 3 different transits, 1 full transit and 2 partial transits in May and July of 2003. These are the observations, and the model fit to those observations. The quick result is that it's a pretty good fit with a ratio of planetary radius to stellar radius of 11%. Semi-major axis measured in stellar radii of about 8 stellar radii, an inclination of 90 degrees, and they should be a bit suspicious about this, why it should come out to be 90 degrees. There is some variation in there, but that this is usually an indication of something's a little bit off with the model if it's trying to force toward inclination of 90. Yep.
Can I make a suggestion for the future?
Yep.
Don't put the backgrounds on the
slides.
Okay. But the printing on the
right
has disappeared from me. I can't see it at all.
Okay. What's the period? The period is 3.1 days.
3.1.
The period is 3.1 days, 3.101289. and so that's the initial, one of the primary results we get is that we can measure the orbital period just from these 3 transits and find out that it matches what you get from the 7 transits with Ogle. But we can do better than that in that we can measure the central timing of the transit and then go way back to the initial transits that the Ogle team measured and use that long baseline to really nail down the average orbital period. And so we get that very precisely. We don't have an estimate of the eccentricity.
We don't have a velocity.
We don't have an estimate of the. We don't have from the shape. I don't have the error bars are not good enough to see a variation from one side to the other. The other thing I should point out is that there was an unfortunate computer crash here on ingress. That took a lengthy reboot to recover from. So that's, you know, basically that's, you know, there are other pieces of, these are squeezed in out of other runs. These are, you know, this one here to basically fill in, and it's just, you know, here we had to start at this point because high winds forced the telescope to be shut until right at that point. This is really too bad because it would be nice to have, you know, a broad flat point there. Yeah.
Is the fact that the scatter is much larger than the error bars?
It is significant, and I'm glad you saw that. The error bars come from, so the technique I used to reduce the data, let me just jump forward a couple of points here. We'll come back to the B-band light curve. That stuff you don't need to know. This is basically a blow up around TR10.
Which one?
Right here. It's the one that looks like Mickey Mouse on the side. I'm sorry?
That's HST.
That is not HST. This is with Magellan. Nope. This is just a straight optical camera. Magellan has an active optic system, which means it's adjusting the primary on a 30-second basis. You have a guide star and what's called a Shack-Hartman star, where you basically use that second star to adjust the shape, the figure of the primary. This image has about 0.4 arc second full width half max. So this is about half an arc second across. So the image quality is quite good, but you can see, and in fact it's a little bit diluted here, that this is a highly crowded field. In fact, you know, there's a star, you know, behind almost every other star, because this is, Ogle points toward the galactic plane. So the stellar density is quite high. In order to get around that, you can't just basically draw an aperture around this object and expect to be able to get millimagnitude precision, because there's, you know, blends of other things, the wings of other stars and small, you know, stars right there. So the technique that I used is something developed by Christoph Allard and Robert Lupton, which is an image subtraction technique. So what you do is this is a reference image, it's essentially the median average of 15 to 20 best quality images in that band that night. So then you take this high quality reference image and fit for the coefficients of a kernel that will transform the point spread function on this image to that of the individual exposures throughout the night. And then once you have that transformation done, you subtract that reference image away, and so almost all of this disappears. And the only thing that you see is the signal from things that moved or things that changed in brightness. So that's the approach, and it's really, in principle, you can get down to the photon limit using that technique. And I say in principle because there are other things that happen. So the going back to that figure, the scatter and the error bars associated with these points are the results reported by the software. It's essentially the photon errors in that difference. But there's a systematic error because, as I said, you want to make a sufficient number of mistakes that the observers think you're an amateur. Well, one of the things that I did on here was, it was half a mistake in that between observations, I shifted the pointing of the telescope. And I had a purpose. The purpose was that I didn't know, there are very fine bad pixels and bad columns on this detector. And by offsetting, I knew that I wouldn't just, you know, if you don't offset, you have a chance that you're going to lose your whole data set. If you do offset, though, you're plagued by small errors in the sensitivity of the detector. And on top of that, there's something called crosstalk in these detectors. This thing has, the chip has four amplifiers, one on each corner of the chip, and it reads out the four quadrants. And amplifiers are notoriously noisy in the sense that one amplifier by induction will induce counts in the other amplifier. And this is at a sort of a 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 4 level. So if you have a crowded field, though, it's likely that, you know, there's some star, you know, off here that's contributing to flux at this point, and that depends upon the physical geometry of the chip. So if you don't move the pointing, that extra signal becomes part of your template image and you subtract it away. If you do move the pointing, that extra signal is varying each time you point. And you can do those corrections, but they take a lot more particular kinds of images that I don't have to do. So that's a correction that I want to try to get on top of when I get back. Anyway, that's what I think is the principal problem with that scatter. It was something like that. In addition, the camera has a shutter timing problem in that the shutter is a leaf shutter, so it's got four pieces that come in, and what that means is that the exposure time across the image is not uniform. That there's a, you know, delta T associated that's pixel dependent, and, you know, I've taken most of that out, but that could also contribute.
No,
the crosstalk term doesn't come out of the flat field, and the shutter correction, is not linear on with exposure time, so it won't come out of the flat field. Okay, so the model is essentially there's several things you want to fit for: the time, the center of the epoch, of the transit, the orbital period, this ratio of planetary radius to stellar radius, semi-major axis inclination, and what are called, you know, limb darkening parameters. So that's basically a way of describing what the surface intensity of the star is as a function of radius of position. And you write this down as this is the angle between the line of sight and the normal of the star is mu. And so you just sort of say this is the intensity of the surface is 1 plus your constant coefficients 1 minus mu and 1 minus mu squared, which is more or less a standard thing. And you can see that, and this is a nice result from Dave Charbonneau, where they went back and looked at HD209458 and broke up the observations in wavelength bands. This is using STIS again. And so you're seeing the relative depths as a function of color. So the longer red wavelengths have less limb darkening, so you have a flatter bottom on the edge. The bluer wavelengths have more important limb darkening, larger limb darkening coefficients. So you'll see a rounder bottom on the edge in the transit. See, the idea, you know, I observed in I band and B band, hoping to be able to make this distinction from the ground. When you do that, you know, you pull out a lot of information about the star, and you get a lot of information about the inclination of the orbit, because there's a degeneracy among the parameters. You could have a larger star with a correspondingly larger planet, larger inclination, give you the same depth as the opposite. But if you actually can measure these limb darkening parameters, you can get away from that ambiguity. So again, this is the basic result in I, and in B, what I've done here is actually not fit for the limb darkening parameters. I put the parameters in that you expect for a solar type star with this effective temperature. And you see in B the depth, if you measure just with the B band alone, the radius of the planet to the star is 0.09. So there's something that's not, I think there's also a systematic error here. You see these points drop down here lower. In B, the image quality was significantly worse. And what's not clear to me, if these points are low, or all these points, this point and after, are low. This is the point at which the seeing changed dramatically. So this is something that I hope to be able to correct, but image processing from here is not the easiest thing to do.
Can you rule out the possibility that it's in effect at 0.13 level?
0.13 level. What do you
mean? I mean, R P over R star. See, in HD209458.
Yeah.
I think that is 0.13 or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm estimating a 1.1 Jupiter radius planet here from the I band.
Right.
And probably I could probably rule out the larger case.
But that would be very important.
Yeah.
Because then you're starting to
constrain theory. Yeah, that's the deal, is to try to get the radius measurement
right
here down.
Limits on the mass?
Limits on the mass, yes. Dimitar Sasolov and his collaborators have done some radial velocity, you know, did radial velocity measurements at the same time that they determined all the spectral information. And they saw no signal at the level of sort of 100 to 200 meters per second. Well, they had two points. And the points, the two points all are actually formally consistent with a 0.7 Jupiter mass planet, but they're two points. Right, so
you have a limit. What, 2 points, how do you draw
different? Yeah. So, you know the other orbital information. So you can put a phase on those points.
Okay.
It's not like you just, stick them in space.
Reminds me once, in 83, mm-hmm. I went to Tucson to give a talk about the dwarf galaxies. Mm-hmm. And I said there's going to be dark matter in them. So Aronson asked me how many stars is needed to measure a velocity dispersion. And I said two. He actually went to measure three. So it's 2 points, how do you?
Yeah. So, but there's one possibility here. I mean, the evidence is lining up that this is actually a planet rather than a blend for a number of reasons. First of all, the light curves are flat-bottomed in both I and B. So that rules out most grazing geometry scenarios. If I take the semi-major axis that you get from the solution is consistent with that which you get from assuming a solar mass and taking the period. Things tie together quite well. The B band has some problem here. There is one false detection case that we can't rule out, and that is early spectral type large star being transited by a smaller stellar mass companion in the background of this G2 star. So you would have basically something that's deeper transits, but contributing say 5% of the flux and diluted by a closer solar type star. So there you would have, you could have broad shallow transits. So there's basically one case that we can't rule out. And so, but this buttresses the case for going back and really working hard to get the radial velocity measurements to.
What is the prospect of that? How, if you use the KIRC.
Yeah, so this
what
is.
What can you do?
Basically, this is a brighter star than TR56.
Okay.
So, and with TR56, they can actually get the radial velocity. So, I believe the Swiss team has some points, and Dimitar has a couple of points, and
so
they're collecting more.
This is a sudden source, right? You can't reach it with KIRC.
You can. You can, but it's they're all southern sources. So TR 56 was reached with KIRC. It's just better to do it from the south if you can use VLT or Magellan, if you have the Shell spectrograph that works well. So it's this is a. All signs are good that this is a planet. There's one possibility that I can't rule out that would be a false detection, and that's the large star, in the background with a stellar mass, smaller stellar companion that contributes a small enough amount of the flux that you don't see it in the radial velocity.
Could that be reality for the interest to you?
I've already put a much more stringent limit on the possibility of a blend in that, the Ogle data has one arc second image quality. And so I've reduced that to half arc second. So the a priori probability is pretty low that it's a blend, and we've reduced that furthermore. And an HST could put even stronger limits. But probably until you actually get the radial velocity signature, you'll still be able to find a scenario where, unless I go back and have, this is probably a candidate for actually doing the light curve with HST, because then if you have the, then you can really measure the limb darkening parameters very precisely. Talk about future work. So, one thing is to go and actually do this on TR56 to measure the planetary radius. These light curves are significantly better than what Ogle produced. And next is to sort of begin a series of transit timing experiments to try to place limits on other perturbers in the system and to try to get these radial velocity measurements. So sort of hinting at, suppose you have a close planet Now, so here I'm talking about 0.04 AU, kind of a three-day period planet, and a second planet in the system. So you can observe the transits of one. What does the influence of the other planet have on the transit timings? And so here I'm showing the interval between consecutive transits as a function of time. And so in the case where I have two Jupiter mass planets, one that transits, so one's at 0.04 AU and one's at 0.09 AU, you see that the transit timings varying by 10 to the minus 3 of a day. So these are sort of minutes, I believe. But if you take the same system, same close-in planet, and give it put a perturber in the 2-to-1 mean motion resonance, and give it 0.05 of a Jupiter mass, you see comparable variations in the transit timings. And these are detectable variations. These are minutes. So from transit to transit, you can actually get these. And Peter, in the paper you had with Greg, you had fit for the second planet in HD 209. Is that do I understand that correctly, that you and Greg Laughlin had done something on
that? There's no solid evidence there's a second planet there.
Yeah.
It's just that there could be consistent with
that, yeah,
which isn't very good so far.
Uh-huh.
It could be, but it's not by no means certain. That
there's no means certain, but you can actually say, you can put constraints on the on a presence of it.
Constraints on the mass of it and so on.
Yeah.
But if, a fraction of Jupiter mass, yes. Mm-hmm. It's got to be low mass.
So, anyway, this is something that I think is an interesting experiment if you, particularly for, say, the TR56 case, where you have a short period planet and you would like to ask the question, is that close-in planet, is a second planet somewhat responsible for additional migration of an inner planet, to try to test this possibility? Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you.